Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're on a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we're back. It's episode 23. We've got lots going on this time round. We've had all sorts of things going on. We've had holidays. We've had busy things in work. Jerry's had a lot of things on. Al's had a lot of things on. I've had a lot of things on. So how's everyone been?
Yeah, I've been good. Busy work as normal. Been away on holiday. I know it's been, we haven't released a podcast for like over a month, but hopefully we get this one out. We get like two out in 1 week kind of thing. So yeah, we're sorry for the relay. Hopefully our sound will be a bit better as well again tonight with Jerry with his new mic.
Yeah, I think I finally have some decent audio, so I must apologise for the audio quality in recent weeks. Technology's been letting me down, so there you go.
it sounds a lot better now, yeah. And we've had audio problems in the last episode, which has just been released anyway, so we're hopefully
finally
back on track.
Out of the door.
Yeah.
All right. So I've got a Windows 8.1 tablet to play with, which I'm quite impressed with, really.
Oh, wow.
One of the guys at work likes to buy stuff and then finds out he doesn't like it and then sells it. So he bought one off eBay and he sold it to me for about 50 quid. So it's nice. A little 8.1 tablet. It's got a 32 gig internal storage. It's got a gig of RAM. It doesn't sound a lot of Windows 8, but it runs really well. It boots up really quickly. It's got like, it must have like some flash storage inside it. But it's really nice to use the Metro interface in it. Because obviously I've been using 8.1 for a long time, but you didn't get to use the Metro interface. And so you can swipe from the left and press the start button, and you then get the Metro interface. And it's, but then if you click on the desktop, you then got a full working version of Windows 8.1.
Is it an 8.1? Because I haven't really played with many of them, but things like the Windows phones only have the Metro interface, don't they?
Yeah, so that's like running the RT version, but this is running the full version. So you can go to the desktop and you get the full computer. So you can click on the little thing down on the little left-hand corner in the bottom, and it brings up a little keyboard so you can start typing and stuff. So you can put all your full apps on this. I've got Google Chrome on there. So you can watch anything you need. Anything like plugins like Now TV or anything, or YouTube, whatever. It's got it. You can support the plugins because it's a fully version of Windows. So
it's x86 rather than ARM.
Yeah, it's got a little. So it's basically got a 1.83 quad Intel Atom processor in it.
Oh, okay.
So, and it works really well. It's got like a little SD card you can put in there as well. Okay, the battery's not that brilliant on it, but I think it's all right. That's what I want to use it for. And also, you can, with the Metro, you can get Metro's apps. And like things like the Kindle app is really good because what you can like swipe with your finger and it goes across if you're writing an Amazon book. And also, you can put the full Adobe Metro app on. And things like where you can, if you get, like, I've got quite a lot of PDFs, you can get different stuff, like computer books or something, or like Linux Voice. If you downloaded one of their when they released after their comments is gone, you can read it like a magazine and you can swipe the pages left and right. So it's like you're reading it on a, like you're physically reading it kind of thing. So it's quite good. So
sounds really good, yeah.
So, but the only thing is you can't RDP to it because they're disabled RDP. Onto and you can't do it to the main, so I'll just basically put TeamViewer on it. So if you want to, like I was setting it up, so you have to set up for your finger, the other's got TeamViewer on it, and then just put TeamViewer on it, and you can jump on it from your machine. I mean, I'll put like the full version of LibreOffice on there as well, so I've got that, so that's quite good. So that's what my little toy I've been playing with lately. So, are you speaking up to anything interesting, Andy?
Well, as we had on our last episode, I was off to go and do a network upgrade. Now, in real time, that actually happened weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it was like 4 or 5 weeks ago, I think.
And things have kind of evolved from that. That job has got done, And I've actually done another one, which is very, very similar to it as well. But it went okay. It went okay, that first job. Yeah. We were thinking about a plan. From the last episode, we were talking about a plan of what I should do. And it went great, bit by bit. There was no problems during it at all. Actually, there was.
I was going to say that sounds really lucky.
It was almost no problems at all. It was a bit more long-winded than Natalie thought it was going to be. Initially they had to move all the desks around. There's a lot more to it with the desks and everything, because when I first got there, I just thought we're going to be unplugging the computers, plugging them all back in again, and that was it. But the guy said, he was actually the owner of the company, he said, right, we're going to take all these computers out, we're going to move this desk here, we're going to put this desk here. So it was good in the end, but every single cable had to come out, every desk had to come out, every computer came out. So as a result, it actually took a long time. I think it was there about 8 or 9 hours on a Saturday to do the whole thing. So once we got the desk sorted out, I could then look at the plan. Now, if anyone references back to the plan that was posted in the show notes from the last episode, there was a few slightly different things or additions to that that I wasn't aware of to begin with. Firstly, there was all the phones in the office. There was 4 IP phones in the office. Of course, they need accommodating with Ethernet ports, which I wasn't aware of to begin with. And also, there was 2 network printers, which also need accommodating with some Ethernet ports. So I took a gigabit switch with me, which was an 8-port one, which should have been plenty. But there was 4 phones and 2 printers that I wasn't aware of. Now, luckily, hidden in the back. In fact, I can't remember where I posted. I think I posted on Google Plus. I've posted some photographs that I took of the mess, and I can quite literally describe it as an absolute mess. When I got there, there was just cables hanging everywhere, bits hanging off here, bits hanging off there, and in the mess, I found a little. There's only 100 megabit switch. But that came in really useful, because I thought, right, we want to utilize this gigabit switch for all the PCs and the NAS drive. But when I found this 100 meg switch, which is quite an old thing, but it's it had 8 ports on it as well, I think. I thought, now that 100 meg switch will be perfect to plug the phones into. Because they don't need high speed. I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think IP phones are only base 10, aren't they, or something? I'm not sure, but they're certainly not fast. They don't need a lot of speed, do they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I was at work, they're all plugged into a gigabit network, but
right.
They've got their pass-through, which is only 100 megabit, so I guess yes. They're gigabit capable, but the pass-through is only 100.
Yeah, I was thinking that with these, because the other issue we had, but luckily I had some spare cables, is we had to run from this 100 meg switch, we had to run different cables independently to the IP phones, because the pass-through is only 100 meg. Of course, previously the pass-through went to the PC on 100 meg. So I had to run a separate cable to each phone. And also I used a 100 meg switch to plug in the printers to as well. I mean, printers don't need a massive speed.
Printers should be fine on 100 meg.
Yeah. I mean, people aren't even multi-printing at the same time necessarily, you know. It takes longer for the paper to come out than the transmission to go to it. So I plugged all them into the 100 meg switch and the IPs into the 100 meg switch. And I plugged all of the PCs into the gigabit switch and the NAS drive into the gigabit switch. Now, a separate thing that I had to do on the PCs, and this is the thing I actually did first, is we got a selection of PCI gigabit network cards to go into the computers. And they all work great, apart from one. And this is where the problem was. One tower didn't have a PCI slot for our gigabit network card. However, it did have one of those PCI Express, you know, the times one connector, which is like the really small one. That's all it had available. So there we were in the middle of this industrial estate in North Wales with the wrong bit. And I said to the guy, right, this computer needs something slightly different. So we phoned around, and I actually wanted to give a shout out to, I mean, he doesn't know who I'm going to, I suppose, but to this little computer shop in Flint in North Wales, because we phoned him up. He knew exactly what we wanted. And we went down there to pick one up, and it was great. So he kind of saved the day in that respect. It was only about 5 minutes down the road as well. So if I'm ever back over that way and I need any bits, then I'll definitely go back there to pick them up. So we got that PCI Express network card back, plugged it in, booted all the machines up to make sure that the drivers took for the cards. And then the rest of the day really was just spent pulling the cables round. Some of the cables were too long for one connection and we had to, you know, use the longer cables for the further ones and the shorter cables for the shorter ones, so we didn't have loads of cables lying around everywhere. And the rest of the day was really kind of tidying all the cables up and making it quite neat. And on the Google Plus, I also posted some pictures of what it looked like afterwards as well, which was actually a vast, vast improvement. And we put them all up on a little shelf so they're all together as well. But in actual fact, the setup of all the devices weren't great as well, because even the bit I was most concerned about was the NAS drive, really. All the PCs took the gigabit network card straight away. Got the NAS drive plugged in. Got the hard drives plugged into it. Got it set up as that RAID 1. So it did format for the RAID 1, which took about 10 minutes or so, something like that. And also used the internal setup in the NAS drive to plug in the USB hard drive to, and I set up a daily backup onto it. That all went great. And then the next hardest bit really was I had to go around every machine and set up the drivers for the printers. Because the printers were USB connected to one PC beforehand, and then it was a shared printer via that one PC. And now, of course, we had them plugged directly into the router. So they were put on an IP address rather than a shared USB. So as a result, I had to go to every machine and then point that particular printer to the particular IP address. And
Sorry, how did you so how did you share the printer? So they were USB to start off with, and then you shared it, what, with a JetDirect box or something, or the back of the printer or something, or back of the Vigo or something?
What, originally or now?
Now, what, how's it set up now?
So now they're all plugged via the switch into the router on an IP address, 1.100, I think. I think I set one as 1.100.
Oh, the printer. Has the printer got a network port inside it? Has it?
Yes.
Then?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. So it had a direct Ethernet connection in it, which they weren't using before.
All right. Cool.
So, so explain the benefits of that, because they said, yeah, because every time we want to print, we've got to turn that computer on. You know. So we're like, well, now you don't. So, ah, great. Okay. So yeah, they were made up with that. All the everything went spot on. It was only not having that PCI Express card for the network card that went wrong, really. We had actually wasted probably about an hour in total trying to find somewhere that had a card and then going down and getting it and coming back again.
So how is the customer thinking? Was the customer impressed then afterwards? They all good report on the Monday morning and stuff? They're really happy with it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It was brilliant, and I give them a demonstration. Once it was all up and going, I said, right, I found one of the they do surveys with video, you see, so I found one of the survey videos on one of the guys' PCs, and I said, right, this video was a gigabyte in size. So it was a gigabyte AVI. And I said, okay, I said, here's a video here. And it's a gigabyte. So I said to them, if you were to download a gigabyte off the internet, how long would it take you? And it depends whether you've got fiber or DSL or whatever. But it's a fair while, isn't it, over the internet, a gigabyte. Mm-hmm. And I said, how long did it take you before to copy this file from that machine to this machine, you know, on the previous network setup? And he said something like half an hour or something. That's how long it took beforehand. I said, okay. I said, let's do a test then. Let's copy this gigabyte file from the my documents in one of the PCs directly onto the NAS drive. He said, okay, yeah. So all I did is a drag and drop, and it was literally, I didn't time it, but it was 20 or 30 seconds. So they were completely impressed with that, because they knew beforehand how long it took. Because if you listen back to the other show, there was shared USB drives, so it was a USB drive shared off one PC, which was shared via a Windows network over a 100 meg system, which everyone was using simultaneously, and it took ages to do anything. And this was the biggest problem that they had. It just took them so long to do stuff because of the network layout. So they're mega impressed by just the fact they transferred a gigabyte file from one machine to the NAS drive in about 20 seconds. So in fact, they were that impressed by it all that their other office, which is in a different area, I think it was last. I mean, that happened about 4 weeks ago, that last job, and then I think it was last weekend. I did exactly the same in another office as well. So they're all made up. So they're all pretty happy with it. So I've got, to go in the show notes for this for this episode, I've got the another diagram, which is basically the finished layout. So anyone can go on and have a look and see what it looked like to begin with. You can see what the plan was, and then you can see what it actually ended up being like. Oh, there's another bit as well, which I didn't really think about originally, but the router that they have is a Draytech router. And the I forgot how many ports are in the front of it, but the Draytech router actually has a gigabit. One of the ports is a gigabit upload port, and the rest of them are 100 meg. So the I plugged the switch into the gigabit upload port. I didn't know I had that. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's really good. So if you look at some of the pictures were posted on Google Plus or Facebook, I can't remember where I've put them all now.
There's a few on Google Plus. I'm just looking. I think maybe you've got more on Facebook.
Yeah, it could have been on. I can't remember which one. I can repost them on the other ones, but I tried to put pictures of before. See the ones before. Some of them look a right mess, don't they?
Yeah.
That's what they were like. I mean, that when we got there, we kind of pulled the desks out and everything. I thought, right, I'm taking a photograph of this. Because yeah. It was, right, that's what it looked like when I got there. You know, one of the guys said, how the hell do you know what goes where? It's like a rat's nest, isn't it? Yeah. And to the untrained eye, it just looks like a complete mess.
But it's a lot easier, though, if you are going to do that, to just rip everything out and start again.
I did. I mean, yeah, I didn't. You know, you could think, well, let's make a diagram and make a label everything that was plugged into everything. But in our situation, we don't need to, do we? We know what we want to do, so it's no point. You don't need to label everything. We just rip it all out and say, right. I had to reuse the cables that they all had there. And so I basically went, right, there's a long cable. So that can be for that device, which is further away. There's a short cable. That tower's only, 3 foot away from the switch. So that can be for that, you know. Because we didn't want cables coiled up everywhere. Tried to run the lengths that were closest possible to it. So it all went very well. So we've done two of them, basically identical, few little differences with printers and stuff, but the two networks that I've done are basically identical to each other, and they're completely unrelated. I'm doing another one which is in a dentist office on the 1st of July.
Cool. So what's the dental office? What are you doing now? Picking up a NAS box in another NAS box or for the
We're just doing the switch for them.
All right. Okay.
Because there's two reasons. The dental software that they use, has been updated several times since the network was installed, and the dental software now uses a lot more data that's transferred between the main storage, which is actually on a PC. It's not on a NAS drive, it's on a PC.
All right, can I ask, what do you know what software it's called? Is it called Kodak or R4 or Software of Excellence, SOE?
It's Software of Excellence, Exact. Software, yeah.
I spent many years playing with that because that's when I used to work for Oasis. We rolled out to 130 sites, so I know that program. I spent many a time night on dental practices copying data from one system to the other. So
I think Oasis have just taken over my local dentist, which I'm going to next Tuesday. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully the software works.
Yeah.
Won't want a software glitch while I'm under anaesthetic or anything.
I was going to say, are you going there for technical reasons or medical?
Medical, unfortunately.
And I say to people, oh, I'm going to a dentist. And they say, oh, why? What's wrong? The computers are not working. Oh, right.
I'm not. At the time, I wasn't a great fan of going to dentists, and like spending most of my life at a dentist practice was not nice. Spending 5 days a week at dental practices. We had 130 practices all over.
Wearing of the drill.
Yeah, 130 practices all over the country, running about to them. Have I ever told you this story about how I scared the living daylights out of a cleaner? have I told this story or not?
I don't think so, no.
Not to me.
All right, so what we're doing, a lot of these sites is that they would have this like software of excellence or whatever. And we would go in and put a new server in. And I'd have like a plan, like what I'd do is I'd have a spreadsheet, and like you'd have to do certain things on every single piece. You've got to do like 10 things, like install the new software, join it to the domain, determine it from the domain. And you kind of get a system going where you like run, like I was like, you do one machine, do a couple of bits on that, and when it's like rebooting, you then run another machine. And then you have to do all this in one night. And this, I think I was in the Ely in London, and no one had bothered to tell them the cleaning people that I was in the building. So I was on my own in this building running about, just computer. And then I went into this room, and there was this woman going, ah, and I go, what? It's kind of like scared living days out of this woman. And I had to explain to her who I was. And I wasn't expecting a woman to be just walking through the dental practice kind of thing. So, yeah.
There's a Big Bang Theory episode. I'm sure lots of people who listen to this watch that, where something similar happens to Sheldon in it. And it says, you saw nothing. And that was a similar thing. He was in the canteen at night and the cleaners turned up. I expected him. But I can imagine, yeah. So was that quite late at night, that, was it? Or?
It's about 10:30, 9 o'clock at night time kind of thing. All so right. Because what you're doing is you'd be there and you'd be transferring data from one server to the other. So, by the end of the year, I'd got it down to a fine art of just getting it, the process of it kind of thing. So,
was that on the exact software, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, and I know what you mean. Copying the data folder or something else.
Yes.
It was, so basically this exact software... a lot of the PCs in the practice are so old, it's unbelievable. But the problem that they're having is because a lot of the data is stored on the one tower, which is in the office, and they're constantly pulling X-ray images, which are just pictures, and documents, which are like letters to hospitals and things like that, to the dental practice, to the dentist room. They take about 5 minutes to log on, and they're constantly waiting for they click on something to bring up a referral letter or something like that, and even simple things like they're waiting 30 seconds for the Word document to open, they click on an image to bring up the X-ray image of the patient before they work on them, and they've got to wait a minute for that to come through as well. And there's several rooms in this practice, and they're all doing this all simultaneously. So we're putting in a gigabit network just to speed the whole thing up, really.
Cool, that's good then.
And of course, nowadays, the guys at Exact are saying, I've spoke to them on the phone a couple of times this week, and they said, and even they've said, said, what speed's their network that they're running? Said, it's 100 meg. He says, Jesus. Yeah. They've sent them an email saying, right, this is what we recommend for our software to run on. So nowadays PCs 4 gig Windows 7 etc gigabit network, and most of the stuff they've got in the practice is 1 gig or 500 meg XP with 100 meg network.
I wonder if you're starting to see 10 gig in a sort of desktop
I know you can get it, but it's not. I don't think it's really standard.
No, I mean, it's in a lot of our servers. You can do it over fibre and sort of DAC cables. But I wonder if it's making an appearance in, because obviously you need a bigger backbone to support that in a sort of big office environment or a server room, which is 40 gig now. So it does make me wonder whether 10 gig will be here soon, because obviously it's getting cheaper because it's being rolled out in the server room. So
there's a couple of motherboards I was looking at the other day, like cheap end motherboards that are now starting to get 10 gig on them. So I'm guessing it's the switches which is going to be the expensive bit, because 10 gig switches in the corporate world are so expensive. I don't know if you can get a 10 gig Netgear or a Netgear router yet. So
not yet, I don't think, no.
I was looking at them for an option for these guys, and it was just too expensive. I was saying, like, the switches, depending on how many ports it is, but you can get a 5-port switch for, 5-port gigabit switch for 10 quid or something or whatever. It's completely affordable, but as soon as you're getting into the 10 gig, it's just mega.
10 gig ProSafe Netgear is $799.
Mind you, I'll show my age a bit, but I remember when 1 gig switches were pretty expensive. Yeah. Or you used to get a couple of 1 gig ports on your 100 meg sort of enterprise type switch. But yeah, that was a long time ago.
What's been, I don't know if anyone remembers, but the BNC network? 10 I remember setting
T.
one up at, was that 10 base, was it? Yeah, because I remember setting one up at home, and you had to daisy chain them with a looping resistor at the end of the line.
And a terminator.
Ethernet cables. Yeah. And they were 10, but they were base 10.
Yes, 10 base T, yeah.
Right, yeah.
That's what I first
I'm not that old. I never got to play with those.
Yeah, I got to play it. And it's one of them, if any one cable died in the chain, then it'd be everyone off the network. And I remember the old days when it used to be, that was like Windows 95, was it? And you had to get the right driver for it to work. And you had to remember to make sure you get the net, and you had to put the net buoy. You had to remember to install the TCP/IP stack and the net buoy stack, didn't you?
I remember that, because it came with net BIOS only or something, didn't it? And I did a lot of, I think one place that was, pretty much my first IT job, I insisted on getting this model of network card. I think it was 3COM 905, because Windows 95 supported it out of the box. And you didn't have to muck around with floppy disks to install network drivers.
Yeah, I think I've got a load of them in the loft as well, because it's just so handy to have. But.
Yeah. Oh, those were the days.
You're looking, apparently, if you want a 10 gig card, they're for a brand new one, you're talking from £200 up. That's for a cheap StarTech one.
Would be good, though, wouldn't it?
You use them in their storage servers at work, and they've got, I think it's Arista 10 gig switches.
The problem is, in order to utilize that, everything in the chain, it has to be 10 gig, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the backbone then has to be 40 gig to properly to use it. So, but yeah.
Yeah, we do quite a lot of 10 gig at work when we do from our ESX hosts, our blade chassis. So normally we'd have something like an A series switch HP, and then from the blade enclosure you'd have 10 links, 10 gig. Four 10 gig links, so you have a 40 gig backbone between the two. So yeah, it's interesting. But especially with iSCSI these days, you definitely need to want to work with 10 gig, because 1 gig these days is not that great for iSCSI traffic.
That customer's doing that for. He asked a question which does seem a bit logical or illogical, really, because he basically said no. He said no with the internet, with your downloads. He said yeah. He said, when we had the original broadband, which he means DSL by that, they were getting 5 meg download speeds, okay, on his DSL. And when they got fiber, as it's advertised, of course, fiber, they're now getting 60 meg download speeds. And so to his understanding, the fiber, in order to get that speed, you have to have fiber, right? Because cable's not good enough. So then with us setting up this network in that place, which is a gig, which is 1,000 meg, or 1,024 meg, if you want to look at it like that, then why aren't we using fiber optic within the office?
Because you don't need fiber for 1 gig anymore. You used to, but you don't anymore.
Right, yeah. And I was saying, well, I thought, well, that's a point. I mean, that's a non-tech sort of coming up with that sort of reasoning. You know, the fiber optic that he gets at his home and at the office is slower than the cable within the office.
But that's always been the case.
It's also, yeah.
It's basically because of the distance
because it travels. Yeah. I said, well, you know, I said, even though you're getting fibre, it's still cable. You know, there's still an actual copper cable going out of your premises. The only difference is that the fibre connection is now much closer than it used to be. You know, beforehand, the fibre connection could have been 5 miles away in the telephone exchange, for example. But now it's in a little green box at the end of the street. You know, it's instead of travelling miles down copper cable, it's travelling, you know, 100 yards or whatever. So yeah.
It's what they call the last mile problem, isn't it? You know, yeah. the infrastructure between the exchanges is amazing and really fast, but it's just that last mile, which is 150-year-old copper cable, yeah. which has been in the ground for over a century or however long, which is a problem. But it's amazing what they managed to do with it. But time to get some cable in the ground now, I think.
Well, we need fibre to the building. That's what we want, isn't it? FTTP. Fibre to the premises.
I wonder if that would ever happen to people's houses, do you think? I suppose in the long run, I suppose.
You know, it will do. It's just upgrading the infrastructure, isn't it? I mean, yeah. A lot of the places, like, I think around the world, I can't think where they've got it, but like a lot of places like Tokyo and stuff have got all fibre to the building, isn't it? It's just really expensive. You've just got to dig up all the road, haven't you? And that's the problem.
Yeah.
To get these cables to the building. So, Jerry, what have you been up to then? So,
I've been pretty busy, really. Just like, as is the thing with freelance stuff, you know, people want lots of odd jobs doing, and they want them doing there and then.
Right.
Especially
now.
Yeah. Especially if they're paying you for the privilege. So, really, I mean, I thought I got away from this with going to Linux, but so there's been some malware removal, but I found quite a good tool to accomplish that. It's called Maldet, short for malware detection, and it's a nice little utility that you just run, you download it, run it, point it at the place that's likely to be infected, which on a web server is your web root, and it goes through all the files there, looks for dodgy looking files, which it does by matching MD5 sums and things, and this one will actually take it out of the web root, so it's away from the website and quarantine it for you. So yeah, that's quite nice. I'm trying to work out a way of sort of deploying that automatically now, rather than having to go around to all the servers I look after and do it by hand. So I'm looking to do it in Ansible, but yeah, it's kind of a work in progress.
So is this what happened after the last episode you were telling us about? when you one of your hosts was kind of
I didn't get to the bottom of that. It stopped happening, don't know. Listeners may remember that it was we knew that the one of the websites on this guy's server was attacking other websites somehow, but it was finding out which was a hard one, because typically people on who run web servers have maybe 40 or 50 sites on there, so it's finding out which one is doing the attacking, and because if you've got a customer's site on there, you don't want to take everyone's site down and put them on one by one or that or you know, some other strategy. You want to try and work out from the TCP traffic what is actually doing the attacking. I put a link in the show notes, last show's show notes, to my Stack Exchange post, and there was an answer in there which I never got around to implementing, but if it happens again, I'll give it a go. But basically, kind of tagging the traffic as it goes out, just so it would appear in the TCP tracing that I was doing. So yeah, if anyone's interested, go and look at those show notes and that link. Another way that people can get up to no good with web servers is hijacking. It's usually a contact form to send out emails, spammers basically. So there's a nice way of finding out which script is doing the deed. You can wrap the binary which is basically the application that's sending the email. You can put what's called a wrapper script, which will output a log, which will then show you the actual PHP file that's sending the mail. There's a way that Plesk, who do this web control panel, have put a nice tutorial together for that. I'll link it in the show notes, but I've almost managed. All these things are almost done, not quite there. of automating that as well, so I can just point my configuration management software at a server and say, run this mail wrapper thing, and it will install it and tell me which PHP file is doing the deed. So yeah, that was exciting.
So you had another you had another one of your websites emailing stuff out, then, had you? Or
yeah, basically a PHP file or the PHP files that make up a website can be used by, you know, if they've got if they're insecure, which unfortunately many people's websites are, they can be used to send out email without, you know, by a bad guy, if you like. Mm-hmm. But I'll put a link in the show notes about how to get around that if anyone's interested. And the other thing, sort of it, probably one of the more interesting projects I've done in the last few weeks is working out how to back up to Amazon S3. There's a nice little utility called S3 command, S3 CMD, which you can use to basically push data to Amazon S3, which is one of Amazon's sort of cloud offerings. S3 stands for Simple Storage Service, and it's basically just a big block of storage. You're allowed to do a certain number of puts and a certain number of gets, so you're allowed to upload a certain amount per month, and they charge you by the gigabyte, I think. And yeah, you just stick your data in there. You can leave it there. You can choose to encrypt the data on the way to stop anyone spying on your data transfer, and you can encrypt it once it's there as well. You know, I don't know how people might feel about leaving their data with Amazon. They're an American company. The NSA can probably read that data if they would like to, but it's handy to have it there. And it's again, it's an off-site backup, as we discussed last week. You know, if your office burns down, then you're going to want to make sure your data is somewhere safe. So yeah, that was working that out was quite interesting.
So is S3 the tier storage at Amazon where it's really cheap to upload, but if you want to download, it's really expensive? If it or is that the Glacier?
Yeah, S3 Glacier is much cheaper, but it's very slow to get the data back. So I actually set this up in such a way, just on the S3 website, to archive the data to Glacier once it's a certain age. So effectively it's a lot cheaper to store, and to be honest, you're not going to be doing lots of restores of this data. This is purely purely to get the data somewhere safe, in case you know the servers go, you know, the building that houses the servers burns down, all the data that this company would need to get back on their feet is somewhere else. Yeah, so that was, it seemed like a lot more work at the time, but that's basically what I've been up to. I mean, I've also been in my day job, in my other life, I've been getting more into using Git, which is, I've talked about in the past, is a version control system for us keeping track of your files, storing your files, keeping different versions of your files so you can roll back. And we're using it with Puppet, which is a configuration management system. And we're trying to use it in such a way that we can roll these changes out in Puppet, these configuration changes, in a sort of a controlled manner, and being able to test and so on. So, yeah, I mean, the way that we're working it is, we take the configuration as it is and clone it, do some work on it, push it to a test group of machines, which is a few machines of each type. Make sure that all works. Leave it for a little while to make sure it works, and then once we're sure that's working, we can push it to the rest of the machines, and we do all that using Git, which is it's all quite interesting. Possibly a bit too complex to explain here, and to be honest, we haven't quite got it nailed down yet. So maybe I can report on that in future episodes.
Cool. I'm going to ask you, Jerry, is I had a kind of issue which I had to fix. One of my, as people I like to use CacDi to monitor, like bandwidth stats on switches. And one of the customers we have set up for, they had to shut down one of their hosts, didn't go down cleanly. So there's a VM running CentOS, and it basically booted up again. But no one had noticed this, and when they'd come, and then someone said, "Oh, can you come and have a look at my stats?" So I went to have a look at it. But interesting, I had a message come up on when it couldn't connect to the SQL database. I wondered if you'd come across this before. It said, "Couldn't connect to MySQL server on localhost. Please make sure valid MySQL databases included in the stats.config.php." So basically, MySQL wasn't running. And what had happened was, is I just Googled it, and I love Google, just enter that, and the first one what came back fixed it. Apparently they had a lock on in MySQL called MySQL.sock. I don't know what that is.
Yeah. What that is it's a Unix socket, which is if you've got a service that runs on a network, you can either connect to it via a TCP port or I think a UDP port as well, depending on the application. Or you can use a socket, which a socket is kind of a special file on a Unix file system, and it's just like a pipe or a plug a plug hole, if you like,
yeah,
where the data goes in and out of. But it's I don't really know how to describe it. It's not a TCP socket, basically. It's a special file that exists and the service communicates through it. So that's what that is. If it hasn't gone down cleanly, then yeah, it's just a case of removing that file, and then when you start the MySQL service again, file will be created, and off you go. The thing that needs to communicate with it can communicate with it, and everything's happy. But yeah, it's sort of a classic thing. If something hasn't gone down, it can just leave something on the file system.
Yeah, but Google just helped me out. I deleted that file.
Yeah,
by doing rm the file.
Yeah,
it confirms it. Then start the service, and it
yeah,
boom, worked. I was like, yay, good old Google.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. It's always helpful. Did you look in the MySQL log when you got the error? Or?
No, I just Googled the error straight.
You often get useful information in the log. Like you would probably have got something like referring to that. And,
I didn't know where to look. Really, I didn't really know where to look because I don't know because not very often I get to come across how to fix Linux problems, because everything works, doesn't it?
So. Yeah, true. /var/log, that's where you need to look.
Yeah.
There'll be stuff under there that will be very handy. I'll use it all the time.
I'll put a link in the show notes to that in case anyone ever comes across that. So.
Nice.
Cool. Who wants to talk next? Anything else? Anyone else? Any stories? Anyone else? Stories you want to talk about?
I don't think so. Did we have any emails since last time? I can't remember if we did or not.
We had an email in from one of the guys we linked to their show there about. We linked to his blog post. And he emailed us. So I've been in conversation with him, so we might be getting on his show. Might be coming on as like a guest. So I wanted to hear back from that. So I don't think about we having any more emails. I had quite an interesting with Windows Update. If one of our great one of the other podcasts, the Mike Tech Show, he was complaining about that he had a pop up keep popping up, which showed you, which basically tells you that Windows is not genuine. So I don't really get involved with PCs not that I really have to. But it was my auntie's machine, so she phoned me up saying that I'm getting this pop up and we couldn't Mike couldn't work out how to get rid of it. When he went to Windows Update, it wouldn't let him run Windows Update. But what had happened was that basically Microsoft had pushed out a dodgy update, which changed the root certificates on the machines, which basically caused this genuine pop-up to keep popping up saying that your Windows is not genuine. But if you go to the control panel and go to computer properties, it said your Windows is activated. So, and if you go to the Windows Genuine website, you can basically run a test and it will tell you if your Windows is genuine or not. And if you went there, it basically didn't work. It basically said that your Windows is not genuine. So, but annoyingly, this pop-up box doesn't come up all the time. And so that's why I ended up going to, is your website genuine? To see if I could work it out. So I was So it was, as you meant to remove this dodgy update and then install an update to fix it. But I had the same problem. I could remove the update, but I couldn't install the update because Windows Update wasn't working. So when you went to Windows Update, it just says, sorry, Windows Update is not working. So when you come in, what the exact message is, but you get the little box where you say, check for updates. It just come back straight away saying, red error. So you can download a fix-it tool from Microsoft that basically just resets Windows Update, but that didn't fix it. So I went into the, what I talked before, Windows Update in the corporate world. You can go to see the Windows directory, back the Windows directory, and then go in the folder in the root of that called Windows Update log. And that shows you in great detail of what the Windows Update service is doing. And it's also, you can check this for home users as well. And in there, it said an issue. It had failed to initialize database. So, this is a bit odd. So I did a bit of Googling. It said you have to delete some files in the Windows directory under the software distribution folder. And then I was thought, hang on a minute. What had happened was about 3 months earlier, her laptop hard drive had died. And it had a 100 or 20 gig drive in it. And I'd basically cloned it. It was dying. She gave it to me, and it was like, you know, the error message you get in Windows. It says, oh, this drive's dying. Please replace it. So I just cloned it to a big drive. Luckily, it worked. And then maybe it got corrupt Windows Update folders. That's why I deleted those files. And then I was just about to give up and say, right, maybe it's just got a dodgy install. I'll just wipe it and start again. And that's what Mike did. But Googling it, I found out that someone said, if you get this error, you need to install the Intel driver for high-density drives. And this guy had said he'd cloned a hard drive. And after he cloned a hard drive from a small drive to a big drive, Windows Update wouldn't work. So I thought, well, might as well give it a go. And I'm going to only waste a couple of my minutes, 5 minutes. I'm going to waste 5 minutes and wasting like 3 or 4 hours rebooting, reinstall it. So I installed this high-density driver, rebooted. Windows Update was working. Explain that one.
Fantastic.
So,
have you seen that? I heard it on Security Now. There's a pop-up for installing Windows 10. I haven't seen it myself because I think it only comes up on Windows 8. But
I have it on mine on 7.
Yeah.
It comes up on 7, yeah.
But people are thinking that that's, you know, something dodgy because...
Yeah.
so you know, people are getting support calls because Microsoft had decided to put this pop-up saying, upgrade to Windows 10 now. And people think, no, that can't be right. Because they've been educated to think that things like that are dodgy. So
it's funny that, because it does sound... Upgrade to Windows 10 for free now. Yeah. Mm. I mean...
They're thinking, yeah, right.
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen it yet, because all my PCs are Windows 7. I've got all corporate editions, so I don't think you get the pop-up come through on the corporate thing. So I don't know.
I have it right now on this machine. So, but it does look... It has the feel of being fake, although we know it's not, but... But there's a way there's a way you can get rid of it. I haven't bothered doing it yet. But.
So you're running Windows 10 on the preview yet, Andy?
No,
or
I
just say?
I've got it.
But
on
you've
an
got
ISO
the little
somewhere.
Pop-up. That
yeah, I've got.
But you say you've got the pop-up box come up. Okay.
I've got the pop-up on my Windows 7 Home Edition. Yeah.
One of the other things that's running across this week is this ready time thing, CPU thing in VMware. We've had one of our customers. We're running maybe a 5 or 6 year old hardware. So I think these are like Xeon processors. I don't know what actual model of processors they are off the top of my head, but they've got a couple of their machines, their heavy machines, it's got like 4 CPUs, terminal servers. They're having slowness problems on it. But if you look at the actual CPU usage in the VM, There doesn't seem to be much. There doesn't seem to be much going on in the VM at all. So I've been looking along. My boss said, "Oh, you want to look at this ready time in actual VMware and see what that is." So what you can do is you can actually go into if you actually command line into basically you can SSH into ESXi, but you have to, it's basically disabled by default, so you have to go into the GUI, the client, and then enable it. And once you've done it, you can basically putty, and you can run a thing called ESX Tops, and it basically shows you like a what all the processes are doing, what's being used. I'm guessing that's the same thing, the top command you get in Linux. Jerry, is that right?
Yeah,
command.
I mean, there's quite a few different tops actually. There's the classic top commands, which shows you things like, you know, how much memory something's using, how much CPU something's using. It's just a text utility, but it's often one of the first things I look at if a Linux machine's in trouble. You can find out if anything's hogging too much memory or CPU. But there's other things. I discovered one the other day called IO Top, which if you've got something causing high IO wait, which is something in Linux, basically the CPU's waiting on IO, or usually hard drive, and IO Top is something that can find out which is the process that's doing that. So you can find it and kill it if you need to. And I think there's another thing called IF Top. I'll have to confirm that though.
Yeah, I've used one in Linux before where you wanted to know what process is doing, how much bandwidth it's taking up.
I think that might be IF Top. A colleague showed me that the other day.
So this ESX Top thing is you can go through, you can press like C, it'll tell the CPU, M, it'll tell you memory. I think there's internet or the interface, and then you can do like storage. But the one we're looking after is this percent ready time, which is basically, so each of the VMs have a virtual CPU, and that's basically the time it's waiting for to get resources from the actual physical CPU. And anything over 5% is apparently bad. So if you've got 4 CPUs, it will say it will be. Anything over 20% is bad. So what's happening is, you heard me talk about this VCP thing, the virtual CPU to core ratio. So what they're recommending, so say like our processors, each of these, I think each blade's got 8 cores. So what they're recommending, what see the back of recommendation is that each core you should have 5 VPCU per core, if you see what I mean. And you can basically watch as ESX Tops, but obviously it just shows you, it just refreshes every 2 seconds, so you can't. So like these top TS servers were like ranging from like 5 to 15 and then 5 to 20. So it wasn't like constantly at 20. But you can run an ESX top in a batch mode, and it basically puts it into a CSV file. And then from that CSV file, you can run it for like, you can tell it to run it every 30 seconds for the next 2 hours. And once you've done that, you can download that CSV file and then you can have a look at it. I didn't know what you could do. Is that it's such a format that you can actually put it into Perfmon. You might have heard me talk about it before. It's like the Perfmon tool in Windows, which you can monitor Windows interface with. And you can basically import it directly into that. And you can build nice little graphs for you. And we're finding that these TS servers were like sitting at 50% all the time. They're averaging out about 12%. So it looks like they're just basically just overcommitted all the VMs, so they're going to have to get another blade in the cluster or replace the current blades with new blades, kind of thing. So
what you really want with that sort of data is sort of real time, so have it talking to something like Cacti or something like that to get sort of real time graphing going,
probably. Yes.
Usually that's SNMP or something like that.
Someone's written a visual. Someone at VMware has written a visual one where you basically open the potty. You basically you make sure you've got the SSH open and it can putty into it. I'm guessing using Java, which is a bit annoying. So
yeah, it's probably, I mean, if you can SSH, then you could, because with SSH you don't have to log in and then run and then manually run a command. You can just sort of point it an SSH and then run a command and then close the connection, if you like. So you could possibly get some output to a Linux box there and then somehow push that into Cacti. We use Ganglia actually to do that. So if you can get a number or a figure, then you can push that into what's called an RRD, round robin database, which then Ganglia can read that. So you get more or less real time stats out of that. Maybe we could cover that in a future episode.
Sounds good. I've only got one last thing to say, is about talking about security now. Steve Gibson mentioned about Mr. Robot, the TV series. You should check it out. It's brilliant. There's only one episode out yet. It's a pilot. If you're in the US, you can watch it on YouTube or on the USA.com website. But if not, if you're outside the US, you can obviously use other methods to find it. But it's brilliant. It's basically, it doesn't sound a very good title, as Steve said, but it's about a techie who, for his day job, he works for a security firm, like a security cyber firm. And then in the evenings, he's a bit of a hacker and catching people out and stuff. And it's quite good. It's not your typical, oh, let's make people make things up as like, oh, look, all this text going across the screen or whatever. But it's got really good information in it. Like, it's all about onion routers and stuff and things like the Nexit nodes and stuff. And it's really good watch.
I'll tell you, it's something that I've read recently, actually, is Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. And that's, I would definitely recommend that. This kid gets basically accused of being a terrorist and put in a sort of Guantanamo Bay kind of place after they blow up the Oakland Bay Bridge in San Francisco. And after he gets out, he sort of embarks on this sort of, it's kind of guerrilla warfare against the Department of Homeland Security, and just all using sort of things, everyday, normal everyday things, and it's obviously quite true to life, because Cory Doctorow is a bit of a geek like we are, and you know, so he talks about all these different methods which you know, you could use today, really, and it's because it's all Creative Commons, it's all available, you can download it, you know, get Kindle versions and so on, perfectly legally. So I'll definitely recommend to do that. Or if you want to support the author, obviously go and buy.
He does good books.
Yeah,
I can't remember ones I've read. I've read a couple of them. I can't remember off the top of my head.
He wrote a short story called "When Sysadmins Ruled the Earth," about a terrorist attack and all these sysadmins caught in a data center where they're safe because of the, you know, all the security and so on. And the sort of air conditioning and or whatever, they're all safe from this terrorist attack. And that's a good yarn as well.
Maybe we have to do one. We'll have to do a podcast of the books we've read regarding IT.
Yeah, maybe a Christmas one, a special Christmas one.
Yeah. Cool. That's all I've got ready for tonight, I think.
Yeah, and I think we've just gone over the hour again. So yeah, it's good timing.
Yeah, nothing new, nothing else from me either. So.
Good. All right, then, well, as always, you can email us at mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk or visit our website. I put links on there today for the our Twitter, Google Plus, and Facebook. And Jerry's got a new way of doing show notes where we kind of, on the front page, we just do a little lease of the release of the podcast, and the podcast and the RSS feed has got like a little description of the podcast, what it's about and what we talked about. And then we have in the show notes, we have a link to the show notes, so we can put a more detailed information in there. So
yeah. we took our lead from some of the podcasts that we listen to, so I thought it was a bit of a better way of doing things. So hope you all like it.
Good. All right, so we will speak to you soon.
Okay, see you all soon.
Bye.
Bye.